You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, you could be raising money for conservation programs in the state while you birdwatch this spring. We'll learn about the Great Wisconsin Birdathon, which runs until June 15th.
First, as the presidential primary campaigns draw closer to a conclusion, candidates are starting to look ahead to the general election in November. They're making the case that they have the best solutions for the problems facing America in the present and the best vision for the future.
But our next guest says many of our political leaders are ignoring the past and the valuable lessons that history could offer presidents and their top advisors. Jeremy Suri joins us now. He's Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He's co-editor of the book, The Power of the Past, History and Statecraft. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, in this book, you and your colleagues are making the case that policymakers should pay attention to the lessons of the past, which kind of implies to me that you think they're not, at least not enough. So how so?
Well, our policymakers, because of the pressures of time, Rob, and because of the pressures of the commitments they make when they're out giving speeches, they often find themselves doing things that are more a reaction to what was done yesterday rather than a deeper understanding of the issues. The clearest way to put it is that we're often fighting the last war or trying to undo the fighting of the last war, not thinking about the broader lessons we could learn if we looked beyond simply what we did yesterday, but to a broader past.
So how are you hoping politicians can, if I can use a bad verb, operationalize this? How can they learn enough history and learn lessons from history that are going to help them, you know, in their decisions today and tomorrow?
Well, we make a number of suggestions in our book, and our book is addressed to exactly that issue. We want to begin by recognizing, of course, that most policymakers, like most citizens, don't have time to do the kind of historical research that those of us who are scholars are fortunate enough to be able to do. We're very fortunate to have the time that most people don't have for that. There are three things that I think busy policymakers and citizens can do to be more historically informed. The first is when there's a topic that is a crucial topic for their policymaking or for their lives. It could be the war in Iraq, it could be health care, whatever it is. It's important to find multiple people or authors who have thought about this issue in historical terms and come at it from different points of view. Too often we simply read the history that reaffirms what we already believe, and there are multiple points of view. So seeking out books and authors and experts who see the issue from multiple points of view for conversation and for advice is one thing we can do. Second, we can bring a critical eye to some of the things people tell us time and again that don't actually prove to be true. We're told time and again, for example, that the United States has been a society of small government. But if you look around you, that's obviously not true. Or we've told time and again that the United States has spread democracy to the wider world. You look around and it doesn't seem to be fully true. It's not that those statements are wrong. It's that they're oversimplifications, and we need to be attentive to those oversimplifications and ask critical questions about them when we're electing candidates and thinking about those issues. And the third and final thing that we can do is try not simply to see the past in the same blinded ideological terms we see the present, to move beyond thinking Democrat or Republican, and really look for more complexity. Understand that the world is not divided between left and right or big and small, but in far more complex ways. And we talk in the book about trying to be attentive to complexity.
It seems sometimes we look at our modern day institutions, our modern day borders and maps of the world, and assume that the way it is now, it just sort of naturally happened, instead of seeing it as the product of decisions made by individuals, by leaders, by nations in the past. Do we need to complexify, make our world a little more complicated now than we currently understand it?
Absolutely. And you give a great example, Rob, that we talk a lot about in the book. One of the things that's really important is to recognize that things that look natural usually aren't. They're the result of decisions that were made in a particular time period for a particular purpose, and that purpose might no longer be served by these things that we're not questioning because we've inherited them. And national boundaries are a great example of this. Let's take the Middle East. Most of the boundaries in the Middle East were drawn in the early 20th century or the mid-20th century. 20th century, and they were designed for political and economic purposes at the time, but they don't match up with the lives of people in the region, and they don't match up, quite frankly, with the needs of people in the region. So we need to be open to not simply defending those borders as if they are somehow natural, God-given, but actually thinking about what would be a more appropriate set of borders. That's how, in the book, we argue history can open space for new imaginings, for new creativity, for new opportunities, not imprisoning us in the past.
Talking to Jeremy Suri, professor of history at the University of Texas Austin, co-editor of the book The Power of the Past, History and Statecraft, saying today's American and other political leaders should be learning from history. But Jeremy, I wanted to ask, in a lot of cases, the question is, what history? I think of Germany after World War I. Some people took the lesson of that disaster. We were too militaristic. We started this war. Right. We're facing the consequences. Some said we weren't militaristic enough. We needed to win the war faster and to stifle internal opposition to that war.
Yes.
They won. And the World War II was another disaster as a result. How do we know what lessons to draw?
Well, so this is a crucial point, Rob. There are many histories. There are facts, but there are many interpretations of the facts. And there is no history without interpretation. And good citizens and good policymakers are open to multiple interpretations, and they consider those interpretations seriously, and then they make a choice. And so we're not pretending that history will offer a magic bullet to provide for agreement, but it can inform our debate and it can inform our perspectives. The problem we face today is not that people are thinking about one interpretation or another. It's that they're not interpreting at all. They're simply accepting a simplistic view of the past to inform the present. We would be better off debating these multiple interpretations, thinking them through, and then making policy. That would be more effective. It would give our policy a much deeper understanding of the different points of view that different groups have on a particular issue.
In the book, you write about Henry Kissinger as an example of a statesman who paid attention to history. Now, a lot of people would not agree with a lot of the decisions he ended up making. Why do you see him as a noteworthy example?
Well, and as I say in the chapter there, it's not because his policies were always good policies, and sometimes they were not. But what allowed him to influence policy, what allowed him to change the environment he was operating in, what allowed him to be an effective leader, even if one doesn't always agree with what he did, is that he was able to leverage policy to his purposes. He looked out at the world and he saw where there were historical openings, where there were trajectories of historical change that he could utilize for the goals he wanted. He recognized the changes in China and how that could open up a new relationship for the United States that had not had relations with China for so long. He recognized the changes in Egypt and Israel and saw a new historical opening for agreement between them. So this doesn't mean he always made the right choices, but it means that he saw the opportunities that others did not see because he had a historical understanding of what was in front of him.
As you look at the current presidential race, the remaining candidates, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, are you thinking what kind of lessons they could be learning from history? And what do you think, either as a group or as individuals, what would you want them to be thinking about?
I would want them to be thinking, and I hope they are thinking, about other periods when the United States has come out of economic difficulty with slow growth and with a world of multiple challenges, none of which are overriding existential challenges in the way the Soviet Union was before, but many of which challenge things that we care a lot about. A fragmented world with slow growth. This would be similar to the period after World War I. It would be similar to some of the periods in the late 19th century as well. And what have we learned about effective decision-making in those periods? I think one thing they better recognize historically is that as powerful as the United States is, in these kinds of moments, our power is actually quite limited, and that we have to work with other societies. And one of the historical lessons I hope they look to is the need to be multilateral, the need to find friends, and the need to pursue diplomatic compromise in spite of our being so powerful and so wealthy.
That's what you hope they're paying attention to. Do you think that our presidential candidates and other key political leaders are thinking along those lines?
Well, I think there's some people around Hillary Clinton who are doing that. I don't see any evidence of there being anyone around Donald Trump thinking in those terms, but I don't know. I don't have any direct connection to Donald Trump, nor do I want to have any direct connection to him. So I don't know, but I think there are some people around Hillary Clinton who are thinking and discussing these issues. Whether she is listening to them or not, I don't know, but an effective candidate, an effective leader will have to address these issues one way or another.
Jeremy, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Rob.
That's historian Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas, Austin. He's co-editor of the recent book, The Power of the Past, History and Statecraft.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a study last spring showed Wisconsin roads are the third worst in the nation. We'll talk to a guest who says it's time for Wisconsin to seriously consider toll roads.
First, this spring, teams of bird watchers are raising money for conservation in the state as part of the Great Wisconsin Birdathon. The event is a spring fundraiser for the Bird Protection Fund, and it lasts until June 15th. 2016.
Are you participating in the Birdathon this year, or have you ever participated, whether you're in the Birdathon or not? What kind of species have you seen in your backyard or out birding so far this season? You can call in now at 800-642-1234 or post and find some information, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Diane Packett is with us right now to talk more about this event. She's the coordinator for the Great Wisconsin Birdathon for the Natural Resources Foundation. Diane, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Well, first off, what is the Great Wisconsin Birdathon?
So the Great Wisconsin Birdathon is an opportunity for people to directly participate in bird conservation by raising pledges and donations for the number of bird species that they can see in one day, anytime up until June 15th. So it's much like a walkathon, only you collect bird species instead of miles.
And then, as I understand it, a lot of people sign up as a team, and some of them have fun. They come up with a wacky name and get competitive about it. Can you tell us about some of the teams out there?
Okay, well, the team that's out there right... I take that back. The team that's going out tomorrow is one of our eight signature teams, and those are our really high-flying birders, well-known birders going to the best birding spots in Wisconsin. And that team is the Cutright's Old Coots, and they are birding in honor of one of their old friends, the late ornithologist Dr. Noel Cutright, who was recently inducted into the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame. And they're named after the coot, which is the a water bird that you might see out in your marshes. And so they may be out for as much as 24 hours driving around to the different hotspots in the state, seeing as many birds as they can.
And is this on the honor system? Could you just say, I saw a peregrine falcon and mark it down, or do you have to have some kind of proof?
No proof, but we expect you to really have seen what you say you've seen. Yeah. And I find that birders are mostly a pretty trustworthy bunch.
So talk us through in a day in the life of a team here, or an individual could do this too, I guess. What are they doing? How are they tallying this up and reporting it back?
Okay, yeah. It's true that one person can be a team if you're a solo birder or you just haven't had time or the inclination to find anybody else to go out with you. The first thing you do is you sign up on our website, and that's wibirdathon.org, and you click Start a Team and fill in your information and give yourself a wacky name if you like. And then you pick a day that you're going to go out and see birds, and you then solicit your friends, family, co-workers for pledges and donations and say, you know, I'd like to see 10 birds or 50 birds or 100 birds or 200 birds. And you tell them your story about birding, what bird conservation is like in Wisconsin, what the needs are, what challenges the birds face. And then on that day that you've picked, you go out to your place of choice and tally up as many species as possible. And we do have people who will go out all over the state in a 24-hour storming session. And we have people who spend just a few hours in their backyard or their local park.
So you've got this 24-hour period in which to tally up as many birds as you can. What are some of the record holders in terms of the sheer number of birds seen in a day?
probably the big day record holder is our team, our signature team, Curlew and Screech. That's Al Shea and Randy Hoffman. And their all-time record is 230 species in one day. But that was actually not part of the Birdathon, I don't think. That was part of their own big day. But last year, there was a competition between Curlew and Screech and a challenging team called Cleopatra and the Stilts. And last year, they saw 219 species.
Wow. Talking to Diane Packett about the Great Wisconsin Birdathon. It's going on now, and we've got information about it on the Central Time Facebook page. People can still sign up for this. If somebody wanted to participate, raise money for conservation, spot some birds, what do they do?
That's correct. You can sign up until June 14th, since the competition goes, or the event, I should say, goes on until June 15th. And so just go on our website, wibirdathon.org, and enter your information, and then you can go out that very afternoon, if you like, and spot some birds.
So I noticed that this entire event takes place, at least not all of it, but a big chunk, especially right now, over spring migration, which is when you have a lot of rare birds moving through the state of Wisconsin. What are some of the more rare birds that have been sighted so far?
Well, we had people see whooping cranes on their Birdathon last year. Yesterday, I was out with Team Oregon Juncos in the areas around Oregon, Wisconsin, near my home, south of Madison, and we saw a black tern. Those are not so common. Biblioloons that represent Madison Audubon Society saw a couple of eared grebes at Devil's Lake State Park a few days ago.
And most of the participants, are they the ones you're talking about, the hardcore birders? Or are they people like me who could identify five or six birds and then would need to flip through the guidebook to pick out the rest of them?
Most of the birders in our competition do tend to be, I wouldn't say hardcore birders, but very interested, dedicated birders. And what we're trying to do is reach out to the people like you who might be able to spot five or six birds and need to flip through the guidebook. Because just because you can't identify a lot of birds doesn't mean you don't love birds and want to help conserve them.
How intense does the competition get between the top teams? I assume it's friendly. There's no dirty tactics, but do people really care about winning?
My binoculars have been sabotaged.
That's one I haven't heard yet. Yesterday, we had two teams go out on the same day, and the captains know each other. You know, people do tend to know each other in the bird world in Wisconsin. And the team captains had been talking to each other and found out that they had scheduled their birdathons on the same day. This was our signature team, the Secretary Birds, and last year's top species team, the Muirland Merlins. And so they had some friendly talk going back and forth on Facebook, posting what they saw and where they saw it. And so we haven't had any smackdowns yet. Even last year, we even tried to have a smackdown with tweeting between the different teams, you know, what birds have you seen? Well, we got that an hour ago. but even then, it was so friendly.
Well, we've been talking about the competition and how it's done. Let's talk about what it benefits, what the funds raised, what kind of conservation do they go to? What are some of the bird conservation priorities right now?
Okay, the funds that are raised go directly to the Bird Protection Fund of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, and there are 9 priority projects this year in the Bird Protection Fund, and you can see that on our website, wibirdathon.org. But basically, they go to protect rare and endangered species such as Kirtland's warblers and whooping cranes, and to protect bird habitat that birds need during all phases of their life cycle, such as migratory bird stopover habitat or reforestation of wintering bird habitat in the Osa Peninsula of Costa Rica and Wisconsin southern forests. And some of the projects have to do with bird monitoring, the Wisconsin Bird Monitoring Program and the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas II.
How significant are some of the concerns that you're describing in Wisconsin right now?
I think they're pretty significant. You know, climate change is a tough thing to get a handle on, and a lot of birders think that it's a serious threat. Habitat loss due to development and different land use change is always a serious threat to birds. Window collisions and feral cats tend to be, you know, contentious subjects, like most concerns are. But to people, you know, to a lot of people, they're very real.
Are there things people can do on their own property? And that's whether we're talking about a backyard or a farm or a conservation land, things like that, that can make Wisconsin a better place for some of the birds you're talking about?
Certainly. And one of the projects that we benefit through the Bird Protection Fund is Bird City, Wisconsin. And on the Bird City website, there are a lot of things you can do as far as planting native plants, making your home bird safe, as far as protecting your windows. One of the things you can do is just hold a backyard birdathon party and ask your guests for donations in lieu of that bottle of wine and sit back and watch the birds and raise funds for bird conservation.
I grew up with an avid bird watcher, some would say rabid bird watcher, and when I was dragged along on bird walks with her, there were not very many young people. There were a lot of older folks, a lot of seniors, mm-hmm. which is great. But when I've been out recently and I've seen the birders out there, it seems as though birding is drawing a whole new cross-section of people. Who are birders today?
That's a really good question. And it's true that people that you see in a lot of the bird clubs who go on weeknight evenings do tend to be more senior citizens. But birders are from all walks of life now. They're students, students in conservation. They're the children of conservationists or people who have just joined a nature club. We have some students in our birdathon from Laurie Sulchenberger's fourth grade class at Lincoln Elementary School in Madison Audubon. So we're really diversifying more and more.
Just briefly, Diane, is there a holy grail bird for you, one that you're hoping to see this year?
No, any bird is good.
Diane, thanks a lot for joining us, and good luck with the birdathon.
Thank you. Good birding to you guys.
That was Diane Packett, coordinator for the Great Wisconsin Birdathon for the Natural Resources Foundation. She joined us here to share information about the Great Wisconsin Birdathon, which runs until June 15th, and you can still sign up.
We've got a link to information about the Birdathon on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up, it's taxes or it's tolls, according to our next guest, who says it's time for Wisconsin to think seriously about toll roads. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA with a look at unusual stories of immigration, not just to the United States, but around the globe.
First, the U.S. Department of Transportation said drivers logged more miles in 2015 than in any year in American history, more than 3 trillion miles. Wisconsin is where 60 billion of those miles are traveled. But according to a study from the Local Government Institute of Wisconsin, the Badger State has the 3rd worst roads in the nation.
Our next guest says it's time for Wisconsin to think about using toll roads. Patrick Jones joins us to make that case. He's the executive director and CEO of the International Bridge, Tunnel, and Turnpike Association. Patrick, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much, Veronica. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why do you think it's time for Wisconsin to seriously consider toll roads?
Well, everything that I've been reading about Wisconsin suggests that the infrastructure is not as in good condition as it could be. This is Infrastructure Week, and we know that in Wisconsin, your roads and bridges are not as well maintained as they could be. They've been labeled something like the 3rd worst in the country, and because of the poor condition of the roads, the motorists in Wisconsin pay $700 in vehicle repairs every year due to damaged roads, and that's almost double the national average of $377.
What do we mean by that? Like maybe the struts get shot or the brakes? What sorts of things happen when the roads are in bad condition?
Well, think about potholes. Think about rutting in the pavement, etc. Think about having your fillings fall out because you're driving through potholes, and a similar thing is happening to your vehicle. Even a slightly rougher pavement will have a reduction in the fuel economy of a vehicle. So smoother, better-maintained pavement, roads that don't have potholes, better geometry of roads, all make for an improved and a safer ride.
Now, one of the things that you say is that it's either taxes or it's tolls. What do you see as being the outlook on that here in Wisconsin?
Well, I know at the national level, the Congress has been extremely reluctant to increase the gas tax. They haven't done it since 1992. And as a result, the gas tax has lost more than a third of its purchasing power in that time. And we've seen it lose purchasing power also because of the increased fuel economy of the vehicles that are on the road. Similar things are happening in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Everybody points to the important needs for infrastructure and improving roads, but nobody seems to be able to come up with the money. What tolling does is it puts into place a system in which people pay for the roads that they use. And if you don't use a road, you don't pay for it.
Well, what if someone says, you know, my tax dollars built that road. I put my money into that road already.
Well, that's the old argument that we've already paid for it. And you can think of a situation, let's say with your house. Maybe you bought and paid for your house. The mortgage is paid off. But you still need a new roof because the roof was last replaced 20 years ago. Or maybe you have a lot of new appliances in your kitchen and you need more electrical power to the kitchen, so you have to upgrade that. You have to paint the house or replace the siding. You have to replace the insulation in the house. The plumbing starts to go bad after 50 or 100 years, so you need to replace that. So even if you own your house outright and have the mortgage paid off, you still have expenses to live there comfortably. The same thing happens with a road. Many of our roads in this country were built 20, 30, 50 years ago, and they need to be replaced. That costs money, and tolling can help solve that problem.
Now, this is a debate that we've been having in Wisconsin is getting to be quite a while now, and then tolling comes up as part of this conversation. And one sticking point is that people don't like tolls. Nobody looks forward to going to Illinois and driving on the tollway there. So how do you overcome that?
Well, I think we have to encourage people to think about the roads that they use in a way similar to the utilities that they use. Their electric utilities, their water, their power, their cell phones, their cable bills. Nobody seems to have a problem paying their smartphone bill at the end of the month because it's a lifeline for them. It's a connection to the world through the internet and through texting. But for whatever reason, people look at the road as, oh, that's something that's always been there and always will be there, and we paid for it. But every time somebody gets on the road, and especially when lots of people get on the road at the same time, there is a cost for me to be on the same road with you because it's harder for us to get where we want to go when there's congestion. So we need to think about our roads more as a public utility and less as something in nature that we found and has been here all along.
Do you think that some kind of public relations, public information campaign could change the way we think about the roads? Because people do think about the roads in a particular way.
Well, I do know there's an organization in Wisconsin that I think is trying to get businesses to think about infrastructure and to talk to state legislatures, the state legislature in a focused way. Businesses Moving Wisconsin. And they are trying to band businesses together, people who ship goods from Wisconsin or receive goods in Wisconsin, to let their state legislators know how important infrastructure is to the business climate, to the business community.
We're talking with Patrick Jones right now, Executive Director and CEO of the International Bridge, Tunnel, and Turnpike Association. He recently wrote an opinion piece saying it's time for Wisconsin to get serious about toll roads to pay for infrastructure. And let's take a look at how neighboring states have done when they've adopted toll roads. We know about Illinois. What are some of the others?
Well, neighboring states include Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Minnesota, and Ohio. They all have toll facilities. In fact, there are 35 states in the U.S. with toll facilities that generate upwards of $14 billion a year in revenues to support nearly 6,000 miles of tolled facilities. And in many cases, these facilities, I would say in most cases, they are safer, they're better maintained, they provide a better ride and less congestion than their non-tolled counterparts, because there is a continuous revenue stream supporting those facilities.
If Wisconsin, say, wanted to dip a toe into the tolling waters, is there a way just to place a toll? Have other states put a toll maybe on a select road or two, and has that been enough to sort of help move the books in a good direction?
Well, you talked about public opinion, and one of the things we've heard from the public is that they typically don't like it when states put a toll on an existing roadway. But if you have a new roadway, or if you're reconstructing a bridge, or if you're adding lanes to an existing roadway, then people are much more receptive to seeing the tolls. They can see that a new facility is being created, whether the lanes are being widened, an interchange is being improved, a bridge is being replaced, and they can see where their dollars are going. There currently is a federal prohibition on tolling the existing lanes of interstate highways, but there's a pilot program that allows three states to use that authority. Wisconsin could someday be one of those states.
Now, you've mentioned a couple times in the course of our conversation the word safety. What data is there that it's actually safer to drive on a toll road? Because if you're from Wisconsin and you end up in one of those sort of big log jams around tolls in Chicago, it doesn't feel as safe.
Well, we actually have data from the U.S. Department of Transportation. It's a little bit dated, but it does show a comparison between the fatality rate on toll facilities and comparable non-toll facilities. And this data shows that the fatality rate for toll facilities is a third lower than that on non-tolled facilities. The other thing that's improving safety is the introduction of electronic tolling and more all electronic tolling, where there are no toll booths or barriers on the highway. So you drive underneath a gantry, it's like an archway over the highway, and the electronics read the tag in your vehicle, and you actually pay your toll at highway speed.
Now, 35 states, it sounds like, have tolling of some manner. That's the majority. What is holding back the other states, including Wisconsin?
Well, I don't know specifically what's holding Wisconsin back, other than perhaps state legislators don't want to be seen as imposing another fee on their citizens. But I think the key will be to demonstrate a clear and sustainable value for the citizens of the state. If you look at a recent report from the Road Infrastructure Program that says that poor infrastructure costs Wisconsin drivers $6 billion annually, well, that's a significant cost. And we ought to get public officials to own up to the fact that there are no free roads. You're either going to pay for your roads with taxes or you're going to pay with tolls. And if you don't pay with either of those, then motorists will pay for the poor condition of the roads in terms of the higher maintenance costs for their vehicles.
How effective is tolling alone as a tool at paying for infrastructure and roads?
Well, we like to say that tolling is one of the tools in the toolbox. It isn't the only tool, and it isn't effective everywhere. For instance, in sparsely populated states where there's low density, tolling may not be the most effective way. You might want to rely on the gas tax, or some states rely on the sales tax to build local roads. But tolling can be very effective in areas like Wisconsin that have a fairly dense urban population and have roads that are congested for a good part of the day.
What would you say to people, both in the legislature here in Wisconsin and citizens who aren't so keen on the idea of toll roads?
Well, I would say listen to the people who ride the roads every day. We have examples and voices from people all around the country who really relish the fact that they have an easy pass or a sun pass that allows them to use a toll facility that's safe and well-maintained, that provides them trip reliability, that allows them to get back and forth to work, to school, to church, to other activities in a safe and a reliable manner. those are the people that the state legislature should be listening to. And I think there are a lot of those voices in Wisconsin.
Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Veronica, thanks for having me.
That was Patrick Jones, Executive Director and CEO of the International Bridge, Tunnel, and Turnpike Association. He joined us to talk about his opinion piece. It's called It's Time for Wisconsin to Seriously Consider Tolling. You can find a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, you can join in on the issue at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of toll roads coming to Wisconsin? How would toll roads in the state affect your commute or change your driving habits? What do you think needs to be done to fund road and infrastructure maintenance in Wisconsin, tolls or something else? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about toll roads, maybe, in Wisconsin now, and we're getting your take.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin consider toll roads, take the steps needed to start the conversation? We need a little nudge from Congress, I think, to make that happen. How would toll roads affect our economy, our road conditions? How would you be affected if we had toll roads? Would you be happy or sad? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go to our first caller now. We've got Mike with us in Eau Claire. Mike, hi.
How you doing today?
Pretty good. How are you?
Not too bad. I'm on my way home from work on Interstate 94. And my take on it is 94, 90, I-20, or 29, all are in pretty darn good shape, and they keep them up pretty well. I don't see why a toll road would improve them. What I do see is out on some of the county roads and a lot of the local streets is where we don't have the money to keep those up because the state has cut back on almost all support to the local communities to help them up, keep their streets upgraded.
And Mike, what about using some toll money for some of those local roads, or what about other infrastructure? Would you be up for that?
As far as I'm concerned, it'd be a fat chance the state would send it back down to the counties and the cities again. They just keep taking it away. Why would they change that pattern now?
All right, Mike, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mike. We'll go next to Pat joining us in Wisconsin Rapids. Pat, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call, Mike and Veronica. I appreciate it.
Now, what do you think?
I was telling the Skinner that I am for them if that's where the money goes. But much like the Skyway, much like the Turnpike, them have been sold off to foreign interests. That money is not being returned to the citizenry. If you can't have fiscal responsibility from your politicians, and we've seen that that's not possible, then I don't know how they propose that this will work.
All right, Pat, thanks a lot for sharing that. Worried about if toll money would be used for what it needs to be used for. You can join in. We're talking about toll roads, the possibility of toll roads here in Wisconsin. Taking your thoughts on it now. We just heard a case for toll roads from a guest. Now we're taking your calls and your Facebook comments, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jeffrey on Facebook wrote, "For what it's worth, I do look forward to going to Illinois and using the toll roads. They're well lit, wide, flat, in fantastic shape, and when it's snowing, very well cleared and salted." So yeah, a lot of people dread the Illinois toll roads. Jeffrey, all in favor of them.
Let's go to our callers now. I'll take another call here from James in Tomahawk. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I don't think toll roads in Wisconsin, I just don't think they should build them. You know, I pay a lot of taxes every year, and most of our roads where I'm at are upkept, except for country roads that need more attention than, you know, the highways or, you know, roads through town. I think, you know, if they put in tolls, then, you know, I'm going to be paying more taxes for them to put them tolls in. And who's to say that I'm not going to pay more taxes once the tolls are in for the roads anyway?
And James, just quickly before we let you go, how would you suggest, you know, if not tolls, how do you suggest paying for some of those roads that do need a little more upkeep?
Well, I think that's what the, you know, citizens pay taxes for. Our money goes toward, you know, highways and roads to be rebuilt and construction on them.
James, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it.
We heard from Tom on Facebook who says, either we implement tolls or people need to be comfortable paying taxes to maintain our roads. You simply can't have it both ways. Tom says the reality is we live in Wisconsin. The winters here, along with high commercial freight traffic, necessitate frequent road maintenance and repairs. Tom, thanks for sharing that on Facebook. We'll go to another caller now as we talk about the idea of toll roads in Wisconsin. Sarah is calling from outside of Madison. Sarah, hi.
Hi. My comment is I'm wondering if there's a blend of things that we could do because, you know, people coming into the state maybe could pay via toll, but for us within the state, I know there are city and rural, and some people's semis would affect the road so much more than my little Honda Civic, so couldn't we figure out a matrix and kind of tax people as they use the road?
Sarah, that's interesting. And people talk about user fees or vehicle user fees where your vehicle would be taxed once a little more than it is now. Is that something? But I guess not necessarily based on how much you use the roads. What would you think of that?
Yeah, I think there could be a solution. I feel like, you know, actuaries figure these things out for insurance. I don't see why someone really smart with math couldn't figure that out for roads.
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. Not necessarily toll roads, Sarah's saying, but some kind of a user fee based on how much you use Wisconsin roads.
And on the question of tolls, Tim on Facebook says, tolls slow down traffic, create headaches, and disproportionately affect poor people, raise the gas tax, raise the income tax, do anything but add time-consuming, traffic-inducing tolls. Don't be like Illinois. So there's Tim's sentiment on Facebook. What do you think? Might be time for your call yet today, 800-642-1234. And we go next to Susie in Pewaukee. Susie, hi.
Hi. I was just going to mention that as the trend is for fewer drivers and people living more where they use public transportation and things, and it seems to me that there's also a trend in the younger groups to not do so much brick-and-mortar store shopping but have things delivered. So while they're not using the roads, they're depending on a lot of truck delivery.
Interesting point, Susie. Thanks for that. Susie's saying that the delivery, the way we like things delivered door-to-door can cause a wear and tear on the roads.
Thanks, Susie. We go next to Otter in Eau Claire. Hi.
Speaking of delivery, yeah, I've been a semi-truck driver for over 10 years, and I've been on most of the toll roads in the United States. Oklahoma and Pennsylvania, for two, are really not very good roads, and Indiana had major problems for a while there, and I kept on asking the toll people, how come they're not using our tolls to fix them up? And they said, well, they're not technically under any obligation. They're leasing the right to run these booths and stuff, and they can put as much or as little money back into it as they want to.
All right. Thanks a lot for sharing your perspective as a trucker. Appreciate that.
And we want to thank you so much for all those calls, everybody. And don't forget, you can keep this conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page. Just search Central Time on WPR on Facebook. You also find the link to that piece by Patrick Jones up there on the Central Time Facebook page while you're checking it out.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.